one of the first questions we can ask. It seems obvious, but it's interesting to ask this question. So why should we use large data sets? Now, two things that are very popular to think about data mining, where we try to gain competitive advantages. There is something economical there by analyzing the data that describes the life of our society. And there is another one that's almost out of fashion, artificial intelligence. You know, we process lots of data, and we process lots of data in about the same time as we perceive it, which suggests that there is a linear relation between the volume of the data and the computational effort. And the first thing is that we can quite easily see that it's the same for data mining. So just take a little society with two kind of computers. You have these guys, they're data makers, they do business, they make revenue. And they also produce data in proportion to the activity. You have these guys, that's Google. They think, they analyze the data to increase revenue by finding competitive advantages. And there is something that is true in the history of humanity, is that the ratio of thinkers over makers is bounded. Otherwise, the thinkers become very hungry. And the data grows with the number of makers. The number of thinkers doesn't grow faster than the data, which means that the computing resources available for learning do not grow faster than the volume of the data, simply because the cost of data mining cannot exceed the revenue. Google cannot spend more money on data mining than they make on advertising, and advertisers cannot spend more money on advertising than they make by selling stuff. So now, most machine learning algorithms demand resources that grow faster than the volume of the data, because they use matrix operations, which is typically n cubed time for n squared coefficients. So of course, you can make refinements there. Right? And you can take two approaches. It can be evolutionary, saying, well, we can tweak the matrix operations so that we can make them better. Or you can be revolutionary and say, maybe we shouldn't think in terms of matrix operations anymore, and this is good for a discussion about coding. But still, we have quite a problem there. So I'm going just to make three parts out of the four parts I promised to the organizers. The first one is a bit theoretical, is try to take a rigorous look at the problem of statistical efficiency and computational cost. The second part is to show some examples of stochastic algorithms, but I go quite quickly because Olivier did it better than me yesterday, Olivier Chapelle. And the last one is try to see how we could learn with a single pass over the examples. So the first part is actually a work with Olivier Bousquet, who is one of the Googlers in Zurich.
I'm not sure I buy this yet. For a couple of decades now, computation, for a fixed cost, the computation has been increasing exponentially.
Yes.
So you might be able to afford n squared sometimes.
The volume of data has been increasing even faster.
Well, the volume of data that you could perceive.
Humans or the room of data that the machines collect?
Well,
we don't care if humans can
perceive more than humans. Well, there's some fixed amount of knowledge in the world.
Well, no. The thing is that if you use an automated machine to make some smart data mining that's going to increase the revenue of such a certain company, it's not clear that a human is going to look at them.
It's like this. Moore's law for high drive is faster as a bigger exponent than for CPU.
Only storage, not
transfer.
Not,
yeah,
but not transfer.
Can we talk about this over cognac? So, I'm going to start with a simple analysis. I read the statistical learning literature, NIPS, in the last 10 years. And it is good to define an objective function that has good statistical property, like a fast estimation rate when number of examples increases. And with the optimization literature, to efficiently solve large problems, well, an optimization algorithm with strong asymptotic properties is a good thing. Like superlinear is a good thing if you can get it in a reasonable cost. Therefore, to address large scale learning problems, use a superlinear algorithm to optimize a good objective function, problem solved, go back to MATLAB, you finished. And well, my point is that this is completely wrong. I'm going to start by the baseline algorithm. The baseline large-scale algorithm consists in randomly discarding data. Well, this is what we do all the time. And the question to ask is, what is the statistical benefit of processing more data, and what is the computational cost? Can we afford it? And to answer these questions, we need to join the statistics and the computation. So in 67, Vapnik did all the statistical theory of learning. He didn't discuss computation, he didn't care, and I ask him, he still doesn't care. He has other interests, which is okay. So in 81, Valiance defines his learnability concept, and he excludes exponential time algorithms. The thing is that it's a nice definition, but there are two problems. There were a few actual results that were actually discussing the complexity. And polynomial time can be too slow already. You know, my point is that the time we want to do is linear. So exponential is far away. So there is a simple way to actually connect these things. So I'm going to start with the typical framework of machine learning. Examples are drawn independently, yes, sure, from an unknown probability distribution. You define this expected risk, which is the expectation over some this distribution or some loss, whatever you wish. We define the empirical risk, which is the average over a training set. And we would like to find this nice F star function that minimizes the expected risk among all functions. And the trouble starts here. So in general, we work with a family of functions that doesn't contain F star. So first approximation. So the best we can do is find the best one in our family of function. But this P is unknown. So well, instead we minimize that one saying it's close, and we have all this VC theory that tells us when this can work. So we make a lot of approximations. So since minimizing objective function is costly, and since we already make lots of approximations, what's the point of computing this exactly? So let's assume we have an optimizer that returns from f tilde n that's accurate to an accuracy rho, like early stopping, whatever you wish. So now the error I'm doing, the excess error, that is the difference between what I'm going to do and the best I could do, are three terms. The first one is the approximation error, the difference between the best function among all functions and the best one in the class we consider. The second one is the estimation error. How much do we lose by using a finite sample instead of minimizing the real function that we cannot minimize? And the last one is the optimization error. How much do we lose by solving a problem approximatively? And our problem is to choose the family of function, number of examples, the accuracy to make this as small as possible given budget constraints, which I'll just simplify in two kinds. Maximum number of examples, because examples are costly. Maximum computing time. It's completely trivial setup. If I look at this, the approximation error decreases when f gets larger, the estimation error bound, we have all the VC theory that tells us what's going on. Optimization error bound, it increases with the accuracy. It's a bit different. Optimization error is defined on the expectations, defined on the probability. The rho is defined on the training set, so there is some things to do. And the computing time decreases and increases in obvious ways. So, definitions. Small-scale learning is when the active budget constraint is the number of examples. Large-scale learning is when the active budget constraint is the computing time. This is different. In small-scale learning, we have plenty of time. To reduce the estimation error, we take n as large as the budget allows. To reduce the optimization error, we take rho equals zero, and the only thing that's left is the trade-off between approximation error and estimation error. This is what you see in NIPS in the last 10 years. It's true. So large-scale learning, this time the active budget constraints is the computing time. And the trade-off is a lot more complicated. It depends on the three variables, family of function. For instance, you could, if you choose the accuracy, you want to optimize very accurately, you decrease the optimization error. But you must also decrease the family of function on the number of examples, with adverse effects on estimation and approximation. So these trade-offs are complicated, and they depend on the algorithm. And that's a good news, because now we can compare algorithms. So what I said just so far is extremely simple. In fact, when I think about it, I just wonder, it took me a long time to just formulate it this way. But it's important, because before large-scale learning, it was an engineering stuff. we should use the algorithm so-so, we should use an optimizing compiler, we should do this. And when you take it this way, you have a clear question, and you can give a clear answer. So my problem is not to just to compute what the answer is. So because I'm lazy, I'm not going to compute exactly, I'm just going to compute orders of magnitude. But I'm going to give a summary of what we're going to find. So that's your optimization algorithm. This is the log of the time, and this is the log of the accuracy. A mediocre optimization algorithm, linear convergence, is something like this. A good optimization algorithm is something like this. And there are some very poor optimization algorithms like this. And it happens that the best accuracy is possibly at this level, where the very poor optimization algorithm is a very good learning algorithm. So they're different. So, Mark, now we need to calculate. So I'm sorry, we're going to have a few questions for a few slides. First, estimation error. We have all this VC theory about uniform convergence bounds, and they basically say that the estimation error decreases like D, which is the capacity, typically the VC dimension of the things, D over N log N over D to a power alpha between 1/2 and 1. So in fact, there are three cases of bound that you consider, and I'll just pass over that. If you add the optimization error inside, because these are uniform convergence bounds, adding the little row inside doesn't change that much. And that tells you what's happening when f is fixed. The approximation error is constant. And in terms of orders of magnitude, there is no point choosing a row much smaller than that, because you already make that error. And it's not advisable to choose a row much bigger than that. So the good order of row should be this d over n and log n over d to the alpha, just to get a scaling law. So now we can go to specific algorithms. Sorry. I wanted to show a slide about what's happening when you want to vary f. So there are bounds for simple cases, but it's a complete mess, because when you want to vary f, you have to consider things like feature selections. It's too complicated. So luckily, there are interesting things to say when f is fixed, is what I'm going to do. But there is a complete open domain there, and there is a complete open domain about what's going on when you change a loss function, like you want to optimize classification error and you use some approximation of the classification error. And what's happening in large scale case, I just don't know. It'd be nice to know. So, case study, f fixed, fw linearly parametrizing w, means that the VC dimension is going to be d. I'm going to compare four iterative algorithms, like the good old gradient descent, first order gradient descent, the second order gradient descent, which is the Newton in one favorable setup, a stochastic gradient descent, and a stochastic second order gradient descent. So I have some quantity of interest, empirical Hessian, empirical Fisher information matrix, but all the goal of this is to define some lambda mean, lambda max, which are eigenvalues of the Hessian, and the nu, which is something that's related to the relation between the Hessian and this one, and the condition number. Not that important. Gradient descent. Each step, wt plus 1 is wt minus eta, some learning rate gain, type derivative. So you know it's zigzagging to the optimum. It's well known that the best speeds achieved when eta equals 1 over lambda max. Cost per iteration, nd. Iterations to reach an accuracy rho, condition number log 1 over rho. Time to reach just the product of the two. And this one is interesting. In this one, I replaced n and basically n rho so that I can reach a certain test error, excess test error as fast as possible. You just take the right value of rho, plug it inside. It's quite simple. If I solve this, saying this is equal to t max, basically it is the answer to my problem, which is the epsilon, the accuracy you can achieve in a certain time, supposing you choose everything right. There are some little things like what's hidden in the big O notation. It's interesting to look. But that's computation constant. Here it depends on the initialization, what's inside, right, both. And here you have some crap that comes from the VC bounds. Now, the Newton version of this, I replace the GAN by the inverse of the Hessian. I'm going to be optimistic. I assume someone gives me the inverse of the Hessian at the optimal. And that's clearly superlinear. The cost per iteration is higher because you have to multiply this matrix by a vector. And you get the same thing here, and you get something here. And what you observe is that the optimization speed is much faster. If you compare, the log becomes a log-log. You lose a little bit of a constant. There is no doubt about that. This is what everybody says. And now if you take the learning speed times to reach a certain test error, well, it's dominated by that term that's polynomial in epsilon. It's not that different anymore. But you gain on the constants can be better. And it's not that different anymore. Okay, fine. Let's go to stochastic grand descent. At each step, we draw a single random example from our training set. And we say, in that case, W3 is WT minus eta over T, the gradient with respect to that example only. So basically, in each point, you have many examples you could draw. So there is a kind of distribution of partial gradients. And they sum to be the total gradient. And you're going to have a very noisy convergence. Now, what's going to limit the convergence speed is this eta over T thing. Because you have a kind of Brownian noise around here, and it's going to decrease with the same order as this. So well, we can calculate, we can show that the best decreasing end schedule is with eta equal 1 over lambda mean. The cost per iteration is ridiculously small, it's d, and if it's sparse, it's going to be even smaller, because there is nothing to do there. The iterations reach a certain accuracy, they're in 1 over rho. And there is not even a big O in front, because the initial conditions, we don't care. What really limits it asymptotically is the decrease of the learning rate, and you cannot decrease them faster because otherwise you wouldn't converge. So product, and time to reach this, oh, we get this. Time to reach a certain test error epsilon. And there are two things that are very bizarre. This is catastrophic for an optimizer. It's really a crappy optimizer, but this is good. No, because this was d over epsilon to d 1 over alpha, with alpha between 1/2 and 1. This is 1 over epsilon. Well, it doesn't depend on the statistical estimation rate. It means that if you choose a loss function, an objective function that has crappy statistical properties, what's happening? It just means that you can optimize to a much lesser accuracy because there is no point, which means that you have time, which means you can use more examples and you catch up. So, well, all these refined bands that try to have very good statistical accuracy with fine-tuning, in that case, we don't care. Well, there is some condition number. This k factor is something that depends on the condition number, but overall it scales quite well. So, if I do a second order stochastic gradient descent, this time I replace my eta by h minus 1. Well, each iteration is a lot more expensive. And that's bad news, because even if your data is sparse, this Hessian is not likely to be sparse. So multiplying can be costly. And what do you get here? Well, something that's very similar. It's 1 over epsilon, just the constants are different. So depending on the condition numbers, you could gain, you could lose. Now, simple preconditioning is going to do good things already, and most of the time, simple preconditioning is going to make the first order more efficient than this. But this has attractive properties that I'm going to describe later in the talk. So, what have we seen so far? That it's possible to define large-scale learning in a rather rigorous way. And that this depends on the algorithm we choose. And that a good optimization algorithm and a good learning algorithm are two different things. The other thing we see is that these stochastic algorithms that are very poor optimization algorithms in the context of learning, they look quite good. It's not extraordinarily better. It looks quite good. So we can study them a little bit. And the theory suggests that this is competitive, and yet most many people associate stochastic random descent with trouble. And the reason is historical. It's been associated with backpropagation. Multilayer networks are very complicated stuff. And the question is, what is difficult? Stochastic random descent or multilayer network? So at some point, I saw the Schaller-Schwarz and Singer talk, and I knew this one. There are some people who show variants of stochastic gradient that perform quite well. And well, the truth is that they cannot publish a paper saying, I just invented stochastic gradient. It was invented 60 years ago. So they have to show something else. So the basic idea was just, let's remove everything and try plain stochastic gradient on the thing they did. So the first one is a text categorization with SVM. It's a Reuters LCV one. We swap training and test and we compute TF-IDF to be right. So that's about 800,000 training examples, just enough to test. This, Olivier Chappell explained how we can do stochastic gradient with SVM. So basically you fold the regularizer inside the loss and you just go that, like that, it's trivial. If you want the code of these things, they are available on my webpage. You can just look at them. It's really very, very small. So, linear SVM. SVM Lite, a popular SVM program, dual, about 6 hours, 7 hours. So Thorsten Joachims has an improved version that's for linear things that use a cutting plane algorithm at 66 seconds. It's a lot better. Stochastic gradient 1.4. And you can compare, I compare the primary cost, which show that this one that we optimize a little bit less, and the test error, they're pretty consistent. So, but that's a strange problem because of the non-differentiability. So some people work on log loss, and Qi Jian Lin, who is a very smart guy, had this Liblinear thing, which is a truncated Newton with a nice trust region, sophisticated thing. And 30 seconds or 44 seconds, depending on the criteria, against 2.3. But on this, I can make a little bit more things. So these are the actual curves. This is the optimization accuracy that I measure after the fact. And that's the training time. This is the Liblinear. So you see, it's below the line. So that means it's nicely superlinear. It's quite good, in fact, because it gives you 10 digits of accuracy after about 1 minute. On this problem with a little bit less than 1 million training examples and 50,000 dimensions. It's not a bad optimizer. So the stochastic gradient descent starts quite well, and at some point, it takes forever. Basically, there is a wall here. There is no way we can optimize the stochastic gradient more than, in that case, 10 to the minus 6, and we're lucky. Usually it's less. Now, what's interesting to look is the testing cost. So the same cost, but measured on test set. When did they get the asymptote around here? Well before the war. So these are orders of magnitude. You know, you could do the stochastic gradient quite bad and move this curve by a constant factor. But you have to move it quite high before the intersection point starts to move in this domain, in which case you are actually in bad shape. So because I didn't want to stop there, actually no. I put that on the web, and I told some friends, and I got this email from Patrick Kaffner with an AT&T. So he tried on his data set, and one of the nice ones is this machine translation, automatic language translation data set with 1 million examples, 250,000 feature, by example. So the libSVM, so typical SVM, takes days. These are SVM by Patrick, which is smart things. Patrick is a smart guy. Well, this is a maximum entropy, that's a kind of approximation. And this is the exact SVM with the stochastic gradient descent. So you go from days for 7 seconds. And so apparently it switched completely now. He told me that in about 10 iterations, it just.
How can you even read the data in 7 seconds?
Oh, that's not the time of reading the data. I read the data and then I start processing.
Ah, okay.
But in 7 seconds, it's about the time you need to get the data from memory. Go once or a few times, and that's it. So then I tried the CRF, so I tried the text chunking task. It's a very big task. It's the goal is to segment sentences in semantically correlated chunks, like noun phrases, verb phrases. There are about 100,000 training segments in 9,000 sentences, not that big. The model is a CRF, or linear, log loss, so something simple. Features are in grams of words, part of speech tags, so the usual. It has quite a lot of parameters, because we need parameters for these things. And well, you take the limited storage BFGS, that's the standard thing nowadays. It's about a little bit more than 1 hour, against 10 minutes. There's some remarks there that are purely cultural. CRF, they come from the hidden Markov literature. And typically, you compute things you need forward, backward. But when you compute gradients, you could do forward, backward, because you can use the chain rule, which is by propagating things. And it's actually 30% faster than the chain rule. If you just look at it, it's 30% less operations. But the culturally, people in CRF do forward, backward. And the last one I'm going to show a little bit later.
So the SVM case is convex, right?
The
SVM is a convex problem.
It's a convex problem.
So gradient descent is a good thing to do. This is a convex problem?
This is a convex problem as well.
Okay.
I've been taking convex simple problems. I'm not going to show much. At some point, I'm going to show examples of things that are a bit. But it's just going to be one slide. Because
this is a little bit unfair, right? Because this is not due to the difference between stochastic gradient and BFGS, this point about forward-backward. It's just difference in how you implement the atomic operation of computing the gradient.
That was just a note. Okay. It's a cultural note.
No, but I'm saying in these two timing numbers.
Well, okay, make this one 20% higher. So what? So choosing the Gantt schedule, actually, I'm going to go fast on this, you know, because Olivier Chappell did much nicer comparison than what I have. Basically, that there are ways to adjust the T0. So eta over T, if you make eta too small, you lose the asymptotic rate, so you should instead put an offset on the T. And how to adjust the offset? Well, in the SVM, I just made some cooking to make sure that the expected initial updates will be comparable to the expected size of the weights. Just a guess, most guess. And for the CRF, I use the secret recipe. So here is the secret recipe. The sample size doesn't change the math of stochastic gradient descent. So what works on a reasonable subsample is going to work in the big thing. So for instance, simple thing, select a small subsample, well, large enough, you know, something. Try value again. See the one that most reduces the cost. It's not written here. Divide by two just to be sure. And use it for the next 100,000 iteration and waiting. There are much more refined ways, and literature contains some of them. You can look at Jan's documents. But this very simple thing works. There is also things like getting the engineering right. I say that these are orders of magnitude, so there are constants. If you get the constants really wrong in my my curve that was a few slides before, in that curve, if you get this thing to the level of this, you're completely cooked. So you should get the engineering right. So for instance, in that case, the problems I had were sparse. So you have this update like this that you can do in two steps. One is to apply the gradient. The gradient is sparse, it's cheap. And the other one is to apply the correction that comes from the regularization term, which is multiplying W by a scalar. This is not sparse, could be costly. Solution one that I learned from Shalev Schwartz is a very cute one, except that he has some limitation. Represent vector W as the product of a scalar and a vector. Perform one by updating the vector, two by updating the scalar. It's exact, it's fast. The only problem is that you cannot do diagonal conditioning with that. Solution two, which is what I would do, is perform step one for each example, perform step two less often. You know, it's a stochastic thing. Do it less often with the higher gain, and it's going to compensate and get the same thing. Now, the next step we need to wonder what's happened if you want to do stochastic gradient for kernel machines. So, in the linear case, both W and the gradient are represented, they're vectors represented using coordinates. And you update the W by combining the coordinates. So, if you have an SVM with a complicated kernel, W is represented by a kernel expansion over the coefficient. Usually the gradient is also a coefficient for times of kernels. So you can just combine the coefficients and you get a simple update. Trivial. Apparently the only thing you need is a good sparse vector library. Well, no, there is a problem. The problem is the sparsity problem. When you do this kind of update, when you do this, you increase your alpha by something. And the only way to decrease alpha is to erode them exponentially when you multiply by this 0.99 somewhere here. So basically, if you at some point you increase the alpha of something that shouldn't be a support vector to a non-zero value, it's going to decrease very slowly. And as a result, you get something that's not very dense. You lose in sparsity, and that slows down the SGD for kernel machines in real life. So there are some dual algorithms that maybe I'll have time to address that avoid this issue, and there are still the problem of computing the kernels, but I just wanted to point out this issue on the SGD for kernel machines. Now, SGD for real life applications. Well, that's an old thing that was done 10 years ago, 11 years ago. It's a check reader. The examples are pairs, an image, and a mount. That's complicated examples. Of course, there's a lot of structure. We know that we should locate fields, we should segment the fields and characters, we should recognize the characters, then we should apply some grammatical and semantic transform to transform a sequence of symbols into an amount. So the idea is simple. Define differentiable modules that are going to do that. So it can be complicated in the details, but it's very simple. Pre-train the modules with hand-labeled data, because labeling data by hand is not that expensive in small amounts. Define a global cost function. In that case, that was a CRF cost function. Basically, you have which one? That's the numerator. You take the value solution that corresponds to the correct answer, and you get the first score. And that's the denominator. You make the ratio, you minimize. Train with stochastic gradient for a few weeks. That was a machine that was a lot slower. And then it works. That thing was deployed in 96, has been running billions of checks for 10 years, and still used, apparently. And it's a complex engineering, it's a complex task. It's non-convex, it's everything. But the fact that we could run something of that size, something like 11 years ago, indicate that, well, you can do things with stochastic gradients. I wouldn't say this is easy, but this is doable. Now, what time is it? I'm going too fast. My third part is about learning with a single pass over the examples. Because, well, storing the examples is just a pain. I don't want to store them. And sometimes there's just too much data to store, and sometimes archive somewhere in the basement, and you need to bribe someone to get it. And this is related to streaming data, to non-stationarities, to novelty detection. And I'm first going to show some properties of second order stochastic gradient descent and show that unfortunately second order stochastic gradient descent, except in some particular case, cannot be done. Then I'm going to show that in the case of kernel machines, which have drawbacks, some of them, happens that you can do something for the time aspect, but not the storage aspect, and then compare. So the first thing is, suppose we have an example, and we add an additional example. So our expectation EN is changed by some little factor. That's small. So you move the optimum by a little bit, and you can do a first order analysis. You get this. That the optimum for N plus one examples is the optimum for N example minus 1 over N, the empirical estimate of the Hessian, the derivative with respect to the new example, plus second order terms. Well, that looks like a second order stochastic gradient descent, hopefully. The difference is that you don't have these second order terms, and you have an empirical relation instead of the real one. But is it important? Could that be that these two processes, that one in fact is defined generalization. It's what's happening when you add examples and how fast you're going to converge to the optimal. And that one is, could it be that they converge with the same speed? And the theorem is yes, they do. under adequate conditions, you know, things about you are not in a nice ball that's properly not too pathologic and everything, the limit of n times f infinity, which is the thing you would like to get, minus fn squared, is the limit of tw infinity minus wt, which is what you get with your second order stochastic gradient, is the same constant. Now the question is, what does it mean? So these two processes converge at the same speed. What does it mean?
How can this even be right, but from the point of view of units analysis?
Units analysis where?
Well, f is measured in units of f, and w is measured in units of
w. Oh, they're the same. F is a function, w are the parameters of the functions.
I know, that's why I'm concerned.
F is in dollars, w is in meters.
You know, Well, what did they say about f? Yeah, I did f, but f is a parameterization for it. It's fine. F is not the function space. I'm in finite dimension. For me, f has parameters. What I call fn is the parameter you get when you optimize an example.
It's w star.
We could call it w star n if you want.
Yeah. It's okay, so go back to
the... Oh. Okay.
Okay, so the first one is the difference between the...
That's the difference between the best solution in f.
The best solution of test set, right?
Yes, that's this one.
And the best solution you get with n examples if you beat optimization to death.
Correct. That one is the difference between this best solution in your familiar function minus the one you get if you do one pass of second order stochastic gradient.
Right. Wait, what's the difference between f infinity and w infinity?
No, they're the same thing. I'm sorry for the confusion notation. Is it clear or should I?
I'll say it one more time to be sure. Say it one more time to be sure.
Okay. What I call f, these are what you get when you optimize to death on the training set, on n exams. What I call W is what you get when you run the one pass at the t iteration of the second order stochastic gradient descent. What I call W infinity is the limit of WT, which hopefully you can prove, is the same thing as f infinity, which is the limit of fn, when you have plenty of examples. So what this graph shows that if you compute your empirical optima on the training set and go to fn, you go to a certain point. If you do your one pass of second order stochastic gradient here, you get wn, and these two distances here, they decrease like k over n with the same constant. So that just means that, well, this one and this one, they're about the same quality on the test set.
So the fn, the rank one, the end of the Brown arrow, has really good training error.
Yes.
And the end of the blue arrow has really bad training error.
Yes.
But the point is there are equal distance from the ultimate test error.
Yes.
Which is not the error.
Yes, on expectation.
No, wait. There's something I'm nervous about. The norm you have here is a norm in parameter space.
Yes.
Not a norm in test error space.
Okay, you can...
So telling me that I am
multiplied by the
equidistant from the
multiplied by the Hessian, both of them.
No, but I might be 1 meter from the optimum parameters north and 1 meter from the optimum parameters south, and those two could have completely different test errors.
Okay. The calculation that says that they converge at the same speed can be carried out in the space of the cost function by just multiplying everything by the Hessian way. It's just a simple calculation. And you get the thing.
But you agree that this statement is not super convincing.
Okay.
No, you said the same. Yeah.
Well.
Do you accept
the idea that if you carry this calculation in the space of cost function instead of the space of the parameters, you're going to get the same thing? Okay, thank you. So that means that given a large enough training set to be in this kind of asymptotic regime, the single pass of second order stochastic gradient generalizes as well as the empirical optimum. So experiment on synthetic data. So that was a stupid thing because it was 19 dimension and millions of examples just to see. So the blue one and the red one are the blue one and the red one. Yeah. So they're really on top of each other. If you look in training time, of course, that's quite different.
Wait, so plug in the test error.
That's the number of examples I'm going to go through.
Right.
It's T O N. I'm just going to one pass. And that's in log scale, the test error compared to the minus the best test error you can achieve, which in that case I could compute exactly.
Yes.
So that's why you have a line with a slope of minus one. And I didn't do it yet, but I can overlay the constant, and it's right. What?
What's on the right?
Same thing, test error, not log scale this time, and milliseconds of calculation. So there are some unfortunate practical issues, that the second RSGD is not that fast, because you need to multiply and estimate and store this D by D matrix. Or maybe you can make refined things. So there are lots of refined things that maybe we could make. And I must say that I don't know about the killer solution for this. I quite like the things of Rodolphe, but I'm not sure that it's going to work. And that's quite nasty here, because you must multiply the gradient for each example. It's not multiplication at the end. It's for each of them you multiply. So it's really not so good. And the sparsity tricks no longer work, because that's likely not to be sparse, even though maybe you can make a nice low rank approximation.
What happens when you try and do a bunch in parallel? Do you know how to?
To do what?
To do a lot of updates in parallel.
Same thing.
Say it's cost of
computing. Actually, if the number is relatively small, it's not going to change much. I know for first order gradient. When you do mini batches in first order gradient, with batches are small enough, don't change anything. Because what you lose in computation, you gain in noise level. It's only when you make the full ones that things change.
So you get a speed up, that's what you
said. No, when you make a mini batch, it's actually the whole training set, then something non-linear happens, because you suddenly your mini batch happens to be the exact gradient. But if you make a mini batch of just a few examples, to compute the mini batch of size k, you need k times more computation. But on the other hand, the variance of the gradients is going to reduce by k.
What I'm trying to get at is, if I give you twice as many processors every year, can you make it go twice as fast every year? Or is there some, are they dependent, these updates, on the previous ones?
Well, they're slightly dependent. I wouldn't be able to increase the number of processors too fast unless I increase the amount of data.
No, you're not increasing the number. Oh, I see.
It's not so easy to implement in a completely parallel setup. But mini batches, they work. It's been done. You can make
but
mini
only
batches.
Up to a limited amount of parallels.
Well, you need the mini batch to be smaller than. Anyway, you want to start in real stochastic. And the more you advance, the more you've seen examples, you want the mini batch size to be small in comparison to the number of examples you already have seen.
Okay.
So
if
you have 8 courses.
But this is, mini batches. The way to think about
parallels. But then you need to distribute the weights, there are some other issues there. Anyway, parallel implementation of stochastic gradient is an issue in itself.
Okay.
Each inverse is quite different for each example, each T.
Yes, that's here I assume this is some estimate of the global range.
Yeah.
But you have to estimate on the weight, which is cost additional. At this point, maybe I should say that there is some case where this is simple. It's when H is diagonal. And there is a nice example with H is diagonal, it's k-means. So, it's something I didn't plan to speak about, but maybe it's not a bad idea. If you do k-means and say that this is the minimization of the discretization error, quadratic, and you write the Hessian, you'll see that the Hessian is diagonal. The diagonal terms are the probability of each cluster. So that's very easy to compute. And when you derive a second order stochastic algorithm to do that, you get the online k-means, where you store the number of examples in each cluster, you divide, and you progress that way. What I've been saying before means that when you do that, and you go once over your set, well, the discretization error you get on the test set is not going to be much better if you keep optimizing. So that's basically a form of one pass k-means. You can do k-means in one go over the data, attaching each stuff only once, and that's it. Now, of course, you have problems of local minima, restarting, initializing, that I can't tell you anything about that. So somehow, a bit by surprise, we find a way to address these issues in a strange setup. Not all of them, it's not perfect, and I'm going to have some. But before, yes, oh yeah, I forgot these two slides. Another distribution. Stopping criteria for stochastic random design, first order. So if we compare second order SGD and first order SGD, the time to reach a certain accuracy changes by a constant. It's k that's related to the condition numbers. And if I can estimate k, I can see that the number of epochs to reach the same test course as the full optimization, it's 1 in the case of second order SGD, is going to be k in the case of SGD. So if I can estimate k, I know how many times I need to spin over my data. How to estimate k? Well, that's easy. If I'm lazy, I can do early stopping with cross-validation. So I keep some data on the side, and I cross-validate, I decide when to stop. And if I really want to use all my data, well, I can do that on a subsample. So I take my training data, I take two nice subsamples, optimize on one, test on the other one, do cross-validation, see how many times I have to spin my stochastic gradient descent. That's an estimate of k. Now I start again, I do k times that on the full set, and done. So it's a nice stopping criterion, asymptotically correct, and that works well. That gives you the order of magnitude of the cycles you have to do for first order stochastic gradient descent. So now I'm going to be, at some point, we looked at kernel machines. They have a lot of problems. You know, you have to store this kernel, this bulky kernel matrix that's dense, that's, you have to manage the kernel expansion, it's nasty. But somehow, there is a strange thing that you can do one pass learning there. That was kind of a challenge. Can we push kernel machines to some point where they're actually useful for large scale problems? So, duality in a simple way. Let's take a SVM. You have the blue points, the red points, you want to find the maximum margin. And I'm going to speak about how margin is SVM, knowing that you can expand that later. The duality is you look at the two convex hulls, and you try to find the two closest points in these convex hulls. You take the orthogonal, you get the same thing. That's the dual view of a support vector machine. So here is an inefficient dual optimizer. You take a blue point inside the blue convex hull, and a red point inside the red convex hull. So this blue point, it's a linear combination of the blue examples with coefficients that are positive, sum to one. Same for this one. Then you pick another example, let's say this one, and you consider this little segment, and you project that on this segment, and you have a new red point. And you pick another one here, do the same thing, iterate. That works, you can prove that this optimizes your computer SVM, and the projection time is proportional to the number of support vectors, not that bad. There are two problems there. The first one is the elimination of unwanted support vectors. It's the same problem that we had with the SGD before. Suppose the pattern X already has some coefficient alpha that's non-zero. So we take that one, and if we take the segment that between the red point and the new one, I cannot make alpha smaller. The only thing that's going to decrease alpha is when I project on other points, eventually alpha is going to be eroded. That's awfully slow. And the solution, which has a nice explanation in dual and cannot be explained in the stochastic gradient setup, is to allow this gamma, which is the equivalent of the learning rate, to be slightly negative, because you know that if you go to that point, you stay in the convex hull. And you can be negative by that level. So the second thing, which is actually an idea that's very simple, but that's going to be very effective, is that when you do that, when you draw your examples randomly to do your successive projections, most of them, they have a coefficient zero, and it should remain so nothing happens. Sometimes, you pull one that's already a support vector, and you adjust it a little bit. But it happens rarely. So, in fact, the examples you draw often to adjust the alphas, you don't draw them very often if you just pull randomly. So the idea is simply to re-equilibrate that. So there is a little stupid algorithm that we call the Huller, and has two steps. First process, pick a random fresh example, do the projection. Second, reprocess, pick a random support vector in the current expansion, project, iterate that. These process steps potentially add support vectors, because you take your fresh example, it could become a support vector. These reprocess steps potentially discard a support vector, because you take a support vector, its coefficient could go to zero. And so these two steps, they also correspond to your memory management. So we got that idea, we tried it, worked well. We made a lot of derivatives of this Antoine board, like the LISVM thing that handles soft margin connected to SMO. There is a version for structured outputs and class problems. We did some work there. And the kind of performance it has, like, this is the LISVM one, which is a variant. It's all the same principle. And this, each of these group of things here, maybe I should zoom. Each group is recognizing the digit one against the rest. And what I have is the yellow thing in the middle, that's the regular SVM code. And the blue one and the brown one are running one pass of that algorithm. So process, reprocess, process, reprocess once. And the purple one is making two passes. What you see is that the test errors that you do in one pass, they're equivalent to the test errors you get with the full SVM. So okay, that's quite nice. So this kind of rebalancing the updates on the examples plays the role of a weak form of second order correction. If you look in the training time, well, things are much better. It goes much faster than the regular SVM. The other lines, the comparison with some perceptrons, you know, just need to do plenty of comparisons. The interesting thing is that this stuff doesn't require too much memory. If you change the size of the kernel cache in the various SVMs, when you decrease it from 1 gigabyte to 2 megabytes, and for various accuracy level, in the regular SVM, the time increases considerably. In that one, it stays constant up to for a long time, because you know, just going one pass is very predictable. The access of the data is very predictable. The only thing you really need to keep are the support vectors that are going to change. Now, if I look at time and memory complexity, and I need to explain, N number of examples, S number of support vectors, L number of free support vectors that are not at the boundaries, that are the ones that are moving, that are the ones that we need to deal with. D dimension of the problem, and in fact, if you look at this hand waving, the number of free support vectors and dimension of the problem, that's about the same thing. D is the effective dimension of the thing. So what you see is that in terms of memory, this thing is about the same as what you would get with a second order SGD. So it's not so good. It eats too much memory. But in terms of time, you gain one order of magnitude. So in fact, you can do one pass learning in that way. In time, it's efficient. In memory, not so much. OK, let's try it. Handwritten digit recognition, on-the-fly generation of examples, local kernel BF, which is the one of the worst models you can use for this. 10 binary classifiers, 6.5 gigabytes of memory, 8 million examples times 10. So it's basically we shuffle 80 million examples to that SVM. 8 days on a single CPU, test error about 0.6 something percent. That runs in one pass. Each example gets only one chance to be selected in that thing. Each example goes once to the SVM. And that might be the largest SVM training on a single CPU. And well, you could beat this if you want, but I think there is no point really. because of this, you take a convolutional network, that's Patrice Sima, stochastic gradient descent, 4 million examples. This one trains in 2 to 3 hours using some nasty optimization that I don't dare to even mention. And tested error is better. So it shows you that first, RBF kernels cannot compete with the task-specific model. Second, that the kernel SVM is slower because it needs more memory. This is the first order thing, not memory used. But it runs in a single pass, in some cases could be useful. So that's my conclusion. So the first thing I did was to show a connection between statistics and computation, and show it in a way that's formal, I can give answer. And I show that there are qualitatively different trade-offs, so small and large-scale learning. You should see them differently. The third point is that planned stochastic gradient descent, first order, both in theory and practice look good. That one pass learning is feasible with second order SGD or dual techniques, still slower than planned SGD for most cases, but it's something to be researched. And there are plenty of things I did not address, like how to select examples, because while taking them randomly is pretty stupid. Quality of the data, weak supervisions, all things that are very important to large-scale learning, but can't address them today. That's it.